But that first bank one, I was trying to find that. I had a lovely afternoon yesterday just looking on YouTube and watching all these old ads for John's and chuckling away. I was trying to find, is it National Provident?
National...
Provincial, National Provincial. Provincial. I know it's got a little girl in it, but I couldn't remember what it was. But
National. Did you find them or not?
No, I couldn't find that one.
Four or five of them.
Oh, those, okay.
There's one with Frank Lowe in it that I know, I sent you.
Oh, Frank Lowe's in it, is he? Yeah. I know he's the account man at the time.
He's in it.
Is he?
When you see it, you think, oh, my God, that's Frank Lowe. It's like so done funny. Like, you know Smith and Jones, where it's the nose to nose?
Yeah.
Frank Lowe and someone else, and Frank Lowe just looks around at the end. And then there's one... I mean, that's the thing. When I was looking through, I've ended up going through all this stuff again. I partly thought over, since I've been doing my blog, maybe 14 years, anything partly John Webster's really covered. Everybody knows all his stuff. But every time I find something, I put it in an envelope. So I thought, well, I've sort of got all that. I won't need to go through it.
Yeah.
But of course, you end up going through it and then trying to plug the gaps and find stuff. So I ended up finding lots of stuff that I didn't know he'd done, like really old stuff.
Right.
And it's shockingly simple. It's to the point of being slight or minimal. You think the scripts is like someone laughing. That's it.
Yeah.
Or they're so simple.
Yeah.
It's incredible. But always the people are like light bulbs. They're just instantly magnetic, amazing casting. So I don't know what to think about. I don't know whether to think, well, it's a different time and you've got to be more complicated now, which is obviously ridiculous. Oh, here we go.
But also there was a lot more repetition then, wasn't there? Because the budgets were so much bigger. So it's not like people only saw them once or twice.
No, that's true,
they had multiple viewings. But I think they were very simple, weren't they? I was looking at the points of view script and the left hand, but there's hardly anything there. It's so pared down.
Is the script in your book?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah. And the brief, interestingly, because you often think, oh, these amazing ads must come out of stunning sort of briefs.
Sorry, guys.
You think the brief must be amazing for an ad like Points of View, and you think, oh, God, I wonder what sort of brief that, and you look at it, is that it?
Do you remember what the brief says?
I've got the book.
Yeah.
It's in there. It's just sort of, I mean, there's hardly anything. There are two bits, well, one bit in it said the paper's quite keen on something that looks a bit like the paper, black and white, ? Or something like that, grainy. Oh, really? And then grainy. And then it uses the phrase, see things from all angles or something in the brief. And then, of course, you think, oh, but then there's a lot of other stuff in there that is nothing like it. And it's, have a look at what the proposition is. It's pretty basic stuff.
Guardian Creative Brief, objective, a campaign that sells more directly the paper and its differences rather than the readers, ? The Guardian's differences. But it's sort of not saying that as an idea.
Is there a proposition or something? Does it say? What the campaign should say. The Guardian makes you make up your own mind.
Yeah.
And then apparently they were sort of inspired by the reporting of the sinking of the Belgrano and how different people reported that in different ways. And then the Don McCullen kind of look came with that. I actually interviewed Paul Whelan when I wrote that, because he directed that, didn't he? And he said he could never understand why John asked him to do that, because that wasn't his sort of ad at all. It was a bit of a...
I wonder why he did.
I don't know. He never really knew. He was very pleased that he did. Yeah. But he said it's just nothing. Just a bit of a random request from John, really. I don't think he ever really quite understood why. It actually made me think of adolescence as well, because I don't know if you read it, but John was insistent that it would be shot for real, with three cameras at different angles. But Paul was just saying, because of the technology at the time, you couldn't ever line the cameras up so you couldn't see the other cameras. So they just kept trying, and John was getting more and more cross, and Paul was saying, no one's going to tell, you can do it. But then in the end, things all got a bit out of hand down in South London where they were shooting it, and kids were hurling the rubber bricks around at people, and John just said, just shoot it in the end, let's just do it. And actually no one could tell, but I think it always annoyed him that it wasn't done for real from different angles.
Still amazing.
Yeah.
And it's Kathy Burke who's in the doorstep.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
You saw the one, a lifter and a leaner.
Yes.
That's what I mean, it's like just... That's such a sort of lovely but small thing to build it on, but it's
They always were small, though, weren't they, really? He didn't really do big things. It was always a sort of little telling detail. He made a lot of stuff. In the book, Dave Trott was saying that thing about John saying that, you know, the thing about you, everything's a drive with you, and you know, but I can drive and I can putt. I mean, just saying that basically he
could just for the raft.
Yeah, he could just, he would always deliver something, and it wouldn't always be brilliant. But there's that's the evidence of it. It's
yeah. What is it? He said
you always swing for the whatever, but I can putt. No, can you drive like you putt? Or I don't play golf.
Or is it the difference between a professional and an amateur is that a professional always delivers.
Something like that. Yeah, which I guess he always got the briefs that no one else could crack. So I guess he just got shot, you know, whacked the stuff out. But we forget about all that. But he also did a lot of stuff that was really wrong. But I suppose that's the pre-testing thing allowed that, really. You'd often put two or three things in, and, you know, it was never just John hit it right first time and there was in it sailed through. There's often two terrible things that went alongside it. You forget all that stuff, really.
So what I guess what I should say is what we're talking about today, which is John Webster and research. And he's like, growing up, he says that he was obviously the person that, as a creative, when you're trying to avoid research, probably through insecurity, because you think, what if they reject my idea? I might not have another one. So it probably isn't for the right reasons, but everybody would always cite, well, John Webster does all right with it. And then you didn't really have an argument, which is the end of all. But nobody really knew how he worked with it, or what happened, or how he could do it and nobody else. And we thought we'd talk about that. So you know about that. And you've written a book on him and you knew him and worked with him. And funnily enough, only last week I was talking to Tom Carty, and I'm making it up, but he said he'd really like to know how John Webster worked with research, because we found an old animatic of Guinness Surfer and we're talking about it. And I said, you're joking, I'm talking to Sarah Carter about that next week. So I think there is a sort of lingering thing that people do wonder, why is he seemingly the only person who embraced it and did brilliant work with it? I mean, I'm sure there's others, but he's the main one.
Mm.
He's everyone's sort of reason for why it's good.
Yes.
So you were just saying that he would sometimes try different routes in there. So he'd use it for his own... So it wouldn't be something that he was forced to do. It would be something he embraced and said, let's try these and see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think he did. I mean, you worked there, didn't you, at some state? He did more than any other creative I worked with quite a special ability, an ability and an attitude that everything was always kind of pretty fluid, really. I think he was, I've heard that he was known as the potter in the department because he could kind of keep reshaping stuff. And yeah, there was that kind of idea that the clay was always wet with him. He did seem to have his sort of attitude to his ideas in the ad was that it was just one long process of evolution, really. It wasn't like, you know, here's the idea and kind of that's it.
Do you think most other people you worked with would be like that? It wouldn't surprise me if you said yes, but...
I hadn't worked with anyone who had the ability to, not just the ability, but, I mean, to remould and reshape. I mean, he would always be pretty cross if you came back and, you know, frustrated if it hadn't worked how he thought it would. But then he'd almost he'd come back the next morning and he'd have flipped it and something would have changed and he would be, oh, this is much better kind of stuff. So... there was always a sort of optimism about him that it could be made better and a preparedness to kind of embrace that. But yeah, I mean, obviously he was frustrated if stuff didn't work. So there was a kind of attitude that it was there to be reshaped. And I'm sure you've read about this as well, but just it was never fixed with him right up to... It was never the kind of validated concept or the script that you then go off and shoot. Just everything was a kind of iterative... chance to make it better, right up to the editing suite where the clients would always, you know, dread the phone call from John because it would be like, oh, I've had another idea how we could make this better, or let's just keep it in black and white, or let's have the sound off, or, you know, so right up to the very end, it was always, it could be better. So that, I think that's probably quite an unusual attitude.
I don't know whether the question is, why was he like that, or why isn't everyone else like that? Because obviously, when you explain it like that, why would everyone not work like that?
Well, I guess the other bit of it was, I suppose he always said, there's no such thing as planning, it's planners. And, you know, there were very good planners at BNP, but also very expert planners at researching ads, which I think was unusual as well. So it wasn't like, oh, the research is going out to some kind of research company and I've never met them and I don't know how they work and they're just going to come back with a debrief and, you know, the computer says yes or no kind of stuff. It was a much more, again, iterative process, you know, that he would work with Bilko on the animatic. We'd head off to the first location, do two groups. We'd probably come back to the agency the next day and tell him how they'd gone, and then we'd go off the next day and do another two. So, again, it wasn't like, oh, off you go to research, and in 3 weeks' time we're all just going to sit there and get the debrief. That was pretty interesting. The clients were in the research as well, invariably, sitting behind the sofa, and that really helped because, you know, there wasn't like a sell-in to them later because they'd kind of seen it, so...
Would John ever go to the research?
Never, no.
Never?
No,
really?
I don't
know. Why do you think that is? Was that better or worse that he did?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose it reflected his confidence that we would come back and sort of... I think there was a trust between him. I mean, I think he hated planners research. If you talk to Chris Powell, he said he absolutely hated it at first, but he came to realise that...
Because the
planners were good and because the clients were there, it actually helped him get better stuff through than the other way, really. I mean, things like the Smash Martians, that went in with two other executions, apparently. I mean, nobody thought the Smash Martians was going to be the kind of winning route or would be any good at all, but that was probably the breakthrough. And then that came back so clearly, everyone loved it, the client were there, so they couldn't really argue with it. And maybe that was the kind of...
The
first time we did research. I don't know if you knew that. There'd been such a disaster with the route before that with Cadbury's Smash that it was so awful. They shot this ad and it was a couple, apparently. The husband had been given Smash by the wife. And the whole strategy was about they'll never notice the difference, you know, that kind of old... and it was just him sitting there in utter silence with a kind of clicking, ticking clock. And nothing happened. And that was kind of the idea that it's all so ordinary and no one will notice. And it was nicknamed Christmas in the Workhouse, apparently, by Chris Powell. It was so kind of miserable and awful. It was never researched, but it was so bad it had to be written off. And Cadbury's said, we'll only pay for this to be written off if from now on everything is researched. So that's how the research and the planners doing the research came about.
From Pollitt?
He would be there then, yeah.
But I can't believe that. I thought they started with planning, so they didn't start with planning. Not planning, with research, with that system.
They started without that. That was the first. There might have been odd bits, but it wasn't like a routine. Because when I joined, everything was research. That was kind of our thing.
Was the first time they'd used research to create ads. Oh, I didn't know that. And that would be, 71 or 2?
And that all went alongside the development of, you know, animatics with Bill. Yeah. And before that, and also being able to use video recorders in people's houses. Because before that, a lot of them didn't have tellies even. No. So planners had to kind of lug around a screen and a kind of recording equipment to sort of do it. So that all came in tandem. Yeah, and then The Martians was the sort of, let's just bung it in and see how it goes type script, which then obviously, we all know what happened with that. And I suppose then for John, that then was the kind of realisation that this could actually be quite good, this sort of thing.
That's interesting. I really didn't. Did John do the silent scripts? Because, funnily enough, I watched one of those yesterday.
Yeah.
And I thought, this can't be BNP. And it's literally, it's slightly different to the one you described, but essentially there's two women on the sofa watching TV, eating mash, and nothing happens.
That's it.
And it's because they're so engrossed in it, they haven't noticed that it's...
Yeah.
And you think,
you'll never
that's probably before
BNP
got the account, I thought.
Yeah, no, that was BNP, and that was one of the unlocks to the to smash. But then I think there was a serious Rivals one that came after that,
really,
which was
that.
Sort of the precursor to
There's
The Martians,
those,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was John as well.
Yeah.
But that was researched.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, The Martians came along then. And then I suppose the planners then got better at doing research as well. I mean, that's the other thing that most planners don't do their own research now. And if they did, they wouldn't be very good at it because they don't do it very often. But we were routinely doing, we had a league table of groups. Yeah. We'd do 100 plus a year. And, say you worked on two accounts, you'd be doing 40, 50 groups a year on a brand. So if you multiply that by an hour and a half a group with eight people, you'd be talking to literally hundreds of users of the brand, so you got really good at knowing what works.
What sort of things would you get better at doing? Just picking up unsaid things, or
First of all, when you brief other people to do research, other researchers, they come back with a debrief, but there's 20 odd hours of chatting to people that's reduced to 20 charts, isn't it? So all the odd random stuff they talk about that might not be super pertinent to that particular project is just gone because it walks off with them at the end of the debrief. But when you're a planner doing that, that all stays
all
on the
useful,
account
yeah.
that you can chat yeah. all the time. So, and also, we'd be often, I hadn't really thought about this, but we'd usually work in pairs. So there'd be two planners and we'd head off around the country. I mean, this is another thing, most research it's done in London now or online even just for convenience. But we would always do two up north, two in the Midlands, two up south. So you were travelling around between them. You wouldn't often come back to the office. You might phone in. So you'd be talking about that research in between the thing, thinking about what you can change for the next one or whatever. So you were just wallowing around in real people
opinions,
and what they thought about. And going into their houses as well. I mean, now that's just really weird. We do it in places like this, a kind of faux sitting room, don't we, with clients sort of either peering through the window or even worse, sitting online watching groups in their kind of pyjamas from somewhere. Whereas there we had our own set of recruiters and our own research thing because we did so many groups. So we'd have a set of recruiters that just worked with us around the country, 30 of these women who did the recruiting for us. So you'd go to their homes, their kids would be coming back for tea with their husbands at sort of 5 o'clock. You'd be chatting to them, the women coming, or the men or whatever, coming to the groups. You'd go and talk to them in the kitchen beforehand. So it's just all just so, much more real, really, than the kind of stuff
so
that goes on now.
So obviously it sounds like research has got worse. You can't pick up as much now over Zoom.
Oh, definitely not. No, and we had the time. So, you'd spend at least the first half an hour, 40 minutes in, what we used to call the warm-up, inverted commas. But that was often the most useful bit because you wouldn't be slavishly following a discussion guide. You'd just be saying, what's going on? What have you noticed? What ads do you like? You'd build up such a knowledge of, I'm quite appalled. I can't remember the last time I sat and heard real people talking about a brand that I work on. You just don't now, which is terrible. You only do it when you look at Gogglebox and you see them talking about ads on that, really, don't you? But so it was just, there was just such a short distance between sitting in a real person's sitting room, talking to them about an ad, and then getting into John's office or, you or whoever else with the creative the next day and then going back and feeding in. It was just, you compare that with now, the distance is just vast.
And presumably on Zoom, people are presenting what they want to present. You're not really getting a sense of who they are, what they really believe.
Not at all. And just the very act of being, I don't think it's any surprise that the kind of this whole way of working grew up on beer ads, a lot of it really. I mean, a lot of our brands were beer, and obviously what better environment than getting groups of blokes with a pint of beer in their hand in someone's sitting room, just sort of chatting anyway. That's kind of how beer works. So it was peculiarly useful for that, I think, as well. So, and we were very tough on our ads. That was the other kind of myth that, BNP planners will let anything through because they're marking their own homework sort of thing. But it was actually the reverse because we felt so responsible for it. We held
Someone
ourselves
trusts you.
To much higher standards, really. So we'd if it was just a kind of okay response, we would probably say we need to go again on it, really. But I guess the other thing was you would be very alert to a random comment that maybe one person had made, which I think if other researchers did that, they would say, it, oh, yeah, you know, it's only one person or whatever. But that often was the most useful bit, and you would be alert to that and, yeah, able to kind of notice it because, you just got quite good at it, I suppose, because you did a lot of it. But
So how would... Because obviously the two homes, supposedly, of... planning were B&P and JWT.
Yeah.
Did they differ, do you know?
Well, I never...
In the way it was done?
I never worked at JWT, but I got the impression that, well, I mean, they certainly were different. I think JWT was a lot posher as a sort of agency. There's a lot of kind of ex-army people there and all that kind of thing, I think, and a lot more built out of ex-researchers, I think, and it was much more about... Well, a lot of sort of, you know, the insight and the strategy and all that
probably
kind of
more formal,
stuff.
Yeah,
I think we were slightly derided as ad tweakers and just more into the kind of just showing rough ads to people and getting the ads good and maybe not with the kind of rigor on the sort of insight and all that stuff that came through from the Stephen King thing. But, you know, some we were talking earlier about some of John's things being built on pretty random things, really, like, you know, there's honey in sugar puffs and you do ads about... I'm not sure that would have come out of the Stephen King sort of... It just all feels a bit kind of easy, really, and not what? Kind of profound enough, but
that combination is probably what you want, isn't it, rather than too cerebral,
yes,
or too instinctive.
Yeah,
I don't know how those how you marry up those things, that sort of instinct, because some of the things particularly looking back and going through all John's work again, some of them are, you know, they're sort of so weird and idiosyncratic that most people wouldn't do them. And then on the other side, you're researching it and validating it, and it seems almost like a clash of
but
things.
I think people like weird and random as anything. I think that was that always went down, really. I mean, I think it allowed so-called irrelevant stuff to actually rise up and work in the way that it really does, really. That, you know, something like barking crows or whatever for cure. I mean, what is that all about, really? It's just
I don't know.
A funny, catchy thing on the name, and it would never have come out of some strategy document. You'd never have got to that, really, but people don't really care, do they? It's did that thing with the crest of bear when that client said, well, why is there a polar bear in it? And John sort of said, well, why not? And it sort of, but it lets
Why was it a polar? Do we know why that was? Cresta.
His backstory, I don't know why, he just came up with this backstory about a polar bear that was fed up of drinking seawater and came sort of south and became obsessed with Cresta. And yeah, there was no more reason to it than that, but sort of who cares, really? It doesn't really matter, but...
Would that be part of the initial selling? He's sick of drinking seawater.
Well, apparently, I mean, I wasn't there, but it'd be he did always present characters with a backstory. I think that was one of the reasons they worked so well. They were very kind of three-dimensional and
I thought that was really interesting that you said he always hated Ronald McDonald because he didn't do anything. He just smiled.
Yeah.
Which I hadn't really thought about.
Yeah. Well, there's that thing that we kind of respect people just in life generally. We respect people for their achievements, but we love them for their flaws. And I think he was very good at making characters and brands actually lovable. I mean, you can't really put a kind of formula on what he did, but actually one of the things he does do, I think, really well is realise that, you know, it's not about the drink or the food, it's about the drinker or the eater. And a lot of his characters were obsessive the product in whatever way, weren't they? So Arkwright about beer, or the Cresta Bear was obsessed about Cresta,
Smash
or
Marshalls.
The Humphreys were desperate to get the straws into the milk, or or Hofmeister was, you know,
John Smith's.
They're all
obsessed.
That rabbit, that Hellman's one who was obsessive about kind of lettuce and his mayonnaise. Yeah. So that if there was a kind of formula. It was a kind of and Gary Lineker.
Yeah, nicking, he's obsessed with the crisps.
Nicking people's
Got
crisps.
Got to have the crisps.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, it's interesting. I've not thought of that.
Because it's quite hard doing food ads, isn't it? I mean, you can't have people saying, oh, yum, yum, it tastes nice kind of stuff. It's, so how do you do that in an interesting way? So
he's doing that. It's so weird that he does lots of things that most people would avoid because it would be considered naff. Yeah. Say that people adore it. I mean, he's getting that through one way or another.
Yeah.
You know, it makes me laugh that lots of his ads, particularly from the 70s, their character literally holds the product and pushes it right up to the screen to fill the screen.
Yeah.
And you think, nobody in quote marks creative is going to do something as overtly selly as that.
Yeah.
He's got this sort of sing-along jingly end lines.
Yeah.
He's got lots of ingredients that you would think would force it over to what used to be like Alan Brady Marsh or something, but somehow they were loved and won loads of awards and remembered. And I don't know why that was, really.
I think he had a kind of pitch-perfect instinct for what people liked. And almost, it's not, I mean, he used the word catchy a lot, and you think, well, that's a really old kind of...
He would say that.
Yeah.
Is it catchy?
Yeah, that's, it feels a very kind of naff word, doesn't it, to use about it. But, and I was thinking a lot of what he did is, well, A, he had quite a childlike sensibility, but B, the sorts of things he used in advertising, the sort of, if you went into a primary school, there'd be a lot of way teachers teach young kids, isn't it? Like repetition. Kind of catchy kind of songs, things that rhyme, things that you want. I mean, he used all that stuff on us grown-ups. I mean, Les Burnett always talks about the best advertising is not about communicating, but about training people, training them for the brand to come to mind and things to be associated with it. And I think that's kind of what John did, actually, a lot of it. But he did it in such a charming way. As you say, it didn't ever flip into what would have felt...
No,
really
it never felt
of...
overtly... Ironically, it never felt overtly selly or crass or...
But it really was selly, as you say.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was
totally branded.
We never did quantitative testing, but the branding would have been off the scale on all of his ads. I mean, it just, they were for Mash Get Smash, all adore you. Know, you couldn't not remember the brand, could you, in there?
So I wonder how he, I mean, we've got a list of qualities here that's come from you. Some of his qualities that went into making that, but I wonder how he picked those up, because it doesn't look like he copied or was inspired by other advertising people. Mm. Might have been, but...
Mm. I think he just had a very instinctive, as you said, sort of understanding of what humans liked and found funny. I think he always kept one foot out of the advertising world, which probably helped. I think that thing that Hegarty always said, you sort of work in advertising, but you don't live in advertising. I think, you know, he has wife as a teacher. He loved his cricket. He loved the pub. He had he was a brilliant artist. He had a great kind of hinterland outside the industry.
I bet he wasn't a member of Groucho's or any of those kind of places.
I wouldn't have thought so. And then,
Or even went to, did he used to go to Cannes? I don't know.
No, hated it apparently. He liked winning the awards, but he didn't like that sort of stuff at all. So I think that probably helped. I mean, Dave Trott always said he didn't really care about what anyone in the industry thought, because he kind of knew he was better than them anyway, so he didn't really care.
Who John thought that?
That's what Trotty said about him. I mean, and everyone says, oh, he cared more about getting letters from kids where they'd drawn about the Martians, or, you know, he'd heard about people getting...
True.
I think it probably... I think he liked winning the awards, but I think he did get more of a kick out of the public reaction to it. There was
through.
That quote I put in the book of it. He was saying how in Rembrandt's day, hardly anyone ever got to see what he did, but 8 million people will see what he writes on that bit of paper. And he would say, well, we better make it good. But also, I think you got quite a kick out of that. I mean, and you would, wouldn't you, if you heard people singing your songs on the streets or writing in asking for Martians. I think you probably got more of a kick out of that kind of reaction than...
Well, he would have got also Danny. We're friends with his daughter, Danny. And so when she was at school, all of her friends would have known most of his campaigns.
Yeah.
Like, not only known them, but wrote off the Straws and Humphrey's Straws, probably wanted Crest the Bear.
Yeah.
Asked for Smash mashed potato.
Yeah.
So you'd be getting all that instant. You could just feel that, how that's cutting into culture.
I mean, it's, fame, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it's
we
fame,
always talk about getting into culture, but that is just people shouting timber in playgrounds and sort of wishing they weren't called Humphrey when people shouted at them in the street.
But again, that's such a weird little, you know, just that straw.
Yeah.
You know, so few people, I think, would think, let's build it around a little paper straw. Or was it plastic in those days? I don't know.
But that was classic,
why
John.
Why is that going to be famous?
You heard about the research on that, originally the Humphreys were actual real creatures, and they had sort of spots and they couldn't walk properly because their bones were not great because they didn't drink enough milk.
Is that the backstory of the Humphrey?
Yeah, and then that was researched in our usual way with the planners, and they just came back and said, this is like the worst thing I've ever sort of researched, because people don't want to see people with spots and kind of creaky bones and people with not enough milk. You know, but actually putting people with lovely teeth and healthy, I mean, that's just boring.
Bland, yeah.
So that's a classic, like, off John goes, and the next day he comes back and says, well, we won't show them at all. We'll just show the straws. And
that's
then,
unbelievable. And then, that's an unbelievable leap.
And because the strategy was all about if you can get people to drink more milk, not about making custard or white sauce. So it was all about encouraging milk drinking, because that's where you'd get more ordering from the milkman. Obviously, a stripy straw is the most brilliant sort of symbol of drinking milk. You don't need any more than that. So, the army of marching straws, and the fact you don't see them is just so much more powerful than if you'd had some sort of little milk-loving creatures there.
But again, that's that thing of both sides, Planning and John, being presented, trashed, and rather than starting again...
Yes, flipping something.
It's hard to even see where you would go with that sort of feedback.
And then there was that flip of the honey monster, you know, when the honey monster was small and kind of messing around, it pissed off the mums because it reminded them too much of the children misbehaving, so he said, let's just make them huge, and then
I didn't know that. So it started off as a small little monster.
Yeah, so that came from a planner, apparently, this is before my time, but the planner came back and said that just when talking to mums, they called their kids little monsters. So he then thought, well, that's interesting, I might come up with a little monster who really likes sugar puff. But the little monster was sort of misbehaving, but it was apparently in research, it was too near their own kids, and mums didn't really like that. And also, it was also researched amongst kids, because at that time, obviously, you could talk directly to kids, and kids said, well, that's not an interesting monster, because monsters are big and sort of smash things up and break things down. So making him outsized and clumsy got around the mum problem.
Yeah.
And also the kids then loved it, because the bit they loved about the honey monster was that. But so it's the same thought of someone obsessed by sugar puffs, but a flip, as you say, rather than sort of ripping it all up.
A
really elaborate backstory on the honey monster started off as honey midgets in a island, and then they had to grow bigger and bigger because they had to get honey from the trees, and then Henry was shipwrecked so he was shipwrecked, came onto the island where the honey monsters were. Honey monster thought Henry was his mummy. Henry took him back to the state. That stuff.
So that would all be presented when the idea was presented.
Yes, yeah. And then became the kind of guiding kind of light of what the honey monster would or wouldn't do over the years as he kind of... And yeah, but you don't imagine Ronald McDonald having a backstory like that.
No, I don't know what his backstory is.
And he was an endearing... lovable character, I suppose, because he did have flaws, didn't he? The honey monster, he'd smash things up, and he was just desperate to get the And if you watch kids watching that ad, I mean, they just love all that bit where he smashes through the walls. And Henry McGee was on Benny Hill, I think, then, wasn't it? That's the other thing that I mean, I hadn't realized, because if you're not around at the time, you don't know, but often they are just people who were pretty famous at the time anyway, in a particular way, or you know, like the smash. Using the person who did the Daleks' voice to do the...
Oh, was it? The Dalek person?
Yeah, I didn't know that. Apparently, John came down to Soho and got the guy who did the Daleks and said, can you do a laugh like a Dalek? And he always thought that laugh was the thing that made that... I think it was, probably, wasn't it?
Well, and also there was that accident that one of them fell over and he kept that in. Because it looked like he'd laughed himself off the
seat. It does look like, and he's sort of rolling around with his little pincers in the air, wasn't he?
I mean, that's one of the other, in this list of qualities, is, I suppose you could say, it's part of that always keeping the clay wet or having your antennae up for things that are not... you hadn't planned, but actually would work really well, which again is most people are focused on getting their script made. I think particularly today it's hard to build in accidents
or to
accommodate them because
it's really hard because of this sort of slavish, you know, validating of research and quantitative testing. And if it's different from the animatic that's got a green all around the world, then no client goes, oh, you know, you can't change that because it might then change everything else. But
so there's loads of there's the, I think apart from the smash one, I know of the leaf falling off on the set, and then they put a little voiceover saying a leaf, and saying there wasn't much going on in the forest that day or something. But they're almost some of the best bits, the accidents.
Well, I think they are. I think he thought they were the best bits. I think I mentioned to you on Points of View originally he had sound effects, kind of street shouting and things like that.
And then when he
looked at the rushes without it and thought, God, this is much better without anything at all, because it becomes slightly hypnotic kind of watching it without any, but that would have been, you know, right.
But it's hard to be in that. I don't know what state that is, because sometimes you sort of, I don't know how you describe it, but you're not really looking at it fresh. I remember reading in Creative Review once about someone describing him, and they said they had this very fancy way of saying he's got a bad memory, which was something like he's got almost no retention. So every time he sees an ad, it's like he's seeing it for the first time. At the time, I thought, well, God, if you was a junior like me, that wouldn't be seen as a good quality. But it does seem like, to some degree, he does look at these things afresh, keep looking at them afresh, which is really hard to do. It's easy to say.
Yeah, I bet. You've got kind of one foot in and one foot out, haven't you? I remember hearing Dave Trott saying exactly that thing, that he went in one morning and John was sort of looking through some scripts and kind of chuckling away at them, and he said
his own scripts.
Yeah, he'd written them yesterday and he just looking at them again was just sort of laughing as though he'd never seen them before. But maybe that was part of his ability, as you say, to actually flip and evolve, that nothing was sort of set and so kind of in his mind. Maybe he just could switch off and come back to it afresh and keep seeing new ways to improve it, because you're right, it's very unusual not to be super defensive, isn't it, and kind of lock down on what you've got and think, you know, and not be open to be able to see it in different ways.
And also you're looking at your last set of changes, not, you know, looking at it completely afresh. You should do, but
yeah, it's certainly a very peculiar ability, but he could do it.
So we've got, he listened to people, spoke to a variety of people and listened to everyone. So I was trying to think of other people, you know, those sort of famous people in our business, like John Hegarty or David Abbott or Dave Trott. And they seem very comfortable in their own opinion and going with it, not getting it checked or validated. So do you think, I mean, John had his own way of working, and it obviously worked out brilliantly for him. Do you think he would be less confident in them than his own opinion, or why do they not do that and he did?
I wonder if it just comes back to that centre of gravity of his, of caring most about what people on the street thought. And if you do, then you want to hear what they think, and you're going to listen to that more than your kind of own belief, really. I mean, but genuinely, you never got the sense when you came back into his office having done some research that he thought, oh, God, you know, here we better sit and listen to this. He was genuinely like, tell me more, tell me what they said about, you know, tell me more about that. I mean, you'd be on that sofa for, you know, an hour chatting. So he was really hungry for hearing all that stuff. Didn't necessarily take notice of all of it, but there'd always be something that he would kind of seize on and...
So it's such an odd combination that you've got him laughing at his own scripts 1 minute and you can't help thinking he's thinking it would be great to make these.
Yeah.
Because they're really funny. And then potentially someone coming back the next day telling them why they're not, people don't find them funny or interesting. To accept that is tough.
It is odd. I mean, there was always a huge amount of, as you say, those kind of little weird, slightly random details that he would, which I suppose you'd never come back and say, oh, the Crested Bear shouldn't have sunglasses on, you know, take that out. And it would never be that level of detail. It would always be that at the level of, you know, the honey monster.
Yeah, it's the wrong.
Yeah, it's a big, so you'd never, it wouldn't be a kind of executional detail feedback. It would be like why the, because it was small, it was reminding mums of the kids or whatever. So, but not, this is what you do about it. That would be him. And then I think just so much of what he did was, the appeal of it was this random stuff, wasn't it? Sort of barking crows or the funny Hofmeister Bear pork pie hat or the crest of sunglasses, you know.
The sunglasses, all which, that. And now the, you say and it, the voice I presume of, that's because of snow blindness in the North Pole. Yeah. But before, you just think, looks cool.
Technically, some more cool.
Sunglasses.
Yeah.
But it probably is to do with the North Pole and snow blindness, which is...
And the fact that was so radically different at the time, because it was just when colour TV had come in, so... Yeah. Every other advertiser would be piling into colour, the more kind of luscious, the better, to make the most of this new medium. And yet he would always say, I'm going to go exactly the opposite way to what's kind of popular at the moment.
Obviously the product jumped out more than anything because it's the only thing in colour being thrown straight in the middle of the screen.
He did quite a lot of that animation, didn't he? That I was thinking that those unison ants like was quite similar.
Compact was in the sort of similar ballpark.
Yeah.
Yeah, that super stripped back.
But you need a big character to cope with that, don't you? Yeah. Because there's not much else to fall back on, really. But I guess you know.
Yeah, it's very exposing, that.
Yeah. But also very childlike, isn't it? I mean, obviously, kids' cartoons are very like that, aren't they? They're very... I think he did tap into our kind of childlike sensibilities really well. He did have some of the... questionnaires that he got given in the A-list and things like that, that he would talk about things that he liked, and he'd mention Laurel and Hardy, Pingu, Jack Tatty. They've all got that kind of childlike, it's like sort of silliness, really, haven't they? But
humanity.
Yes.
I mean, they're all...
Yeah, quite stripped back as well, but I think he...
Visual.
He let that side of ourselves out that we like,
So wouldn't you say he had he took in a wide variety of things? It could be listening to, I can't remember what radio station was. It was like
Terry Wogan was a big one, but also
Radio
3 as well.
Yeah, Radio 3 or Terry Wogan or I don't know if he quite went as far as the Daily Star, but it could be the Guardian and the Sun or something.
Yeah, the Express and the Guardian,
So do you think he did that because that was useful for his job, or do you think he was just interested in all those things?
I think probably a bit of both. I think he really liked sort of Come Dancing, you know, the kind of precursor to Strictly.
I think he
found that kind of thing quite funny as well. So there'd be a bit of that. I mean, he did say he read the Daily Express because that was kind of useful for the job to know what people did, but I kind of get the feeling that he quite liked that sort of stuff as well. He really liked Desert Island Discs, and that's just sort of Hartman people stuff, really, isn't it? Music and emotions and people, and I think he just was genuinely very interested in people and what they were interested in. But I think he, there was that nice quote about Dickens from Chesterton. He said he didn't make what the people wanted, he wanted what the people wanted, and I think that is true of him. I think the stuff he liked was the stuff he created,
popular,
really. But popular, and that's been a rather derided word, hasn't it, really? But
in the last 8 years it's been it's got a slightly different meaning
to the extent that Burnett's, I think, now could talk about making popular as though that's like a really big thing. But isn't that what we've always meant to be doing?
This niche stuff that we've been trying to
do. Yeah, exactly. I did think, like, what on earth would John the thought about purpose and all of that. Yeah. So, I mean, he would have hated all that. I can't imagine whether he
went near purpose. Because if you have a purpose, it's not the end of the world. But most people try and pretend they've got a purpose when they haven't got one. I'm trying to think whether... I can't think of anything that he did that...
No, I mean, I suppose The Guardian may be the nearest to it as a kind of like what they stand for. But yeah, this all feels a bit kind of po-faced and serious really for him. I just think he was very good at realising how insignificant brands were in people's lives, really, and we've all forgotten that a bit.
Yeah.
And it's easier to remember that when you're working on dried potato and kind of drinks with chemicals in, like Cresta.
He did have a particularly... I mean, it must have been a good thing, one of those perfect storms. Lots of the products were...
crap.
The worst of the 70s innovations.
Yeah.
I wonder whether that helped then you had to try harder or be more creative or be more interested, because it wasn't inherently... I'm trying to think of other stuff that would have been around in the 70s in particular.
Well, in that would have been burn back, it would have been airlines and cars. and department stores and things, that, much more interesting things. But I'm sure that was right. I mean if you got to have a bit of humility if you're advertising dried potato, haven't you, and work quite hard.
Because you're literally inventing rather than communicating a particular point, you're inventing it.
Yeah,
it's and there's frothy. Nothing, now makes total sense.
And there's nothing much to say.
It's frothy. Exactly. You've done that.
There's no great role for strategy, really, is there?
No.
It's got honey in it. Yorkshire men would like
it's got honey in it
because it's a good Yorkshire pint. I mean, they're irresistible with Walker's Crisps. There's nothing.
Yeah. What were the planning guys doing at that point in time?
Well, often it's keeping things out, is trying to keep it simple. It's quite hard, that kind of, why is it a polar bear? Why aren't you saying anything more interesting than, isn't it a bit generic if you just talk about it's got honey in it? I mean, often it's about reassuring clients that's all okay rather than coming up with anything.
Yeah, you can look past the obvious
clever.
To try and be clever.
Yeah, I don't think he liked clever planners. No. I mean, they were clever, a lot of them, but he hated all that kind of pretentious intellectual stuff. It's all just keep it really simple and, get the other stuff out of the way.
Have fiery debates with planners about what you should or shouldn't be saying?
I personally never had one. I mean, he wasn't a very fiery person, really. I mean, clients, he would challenge clients. Martin Glenn was, the Walker's client, was always said the clients really respected him. I suppose it helped with the pedigree he came with. But I think they realised that he was a salesman. I mean, he knew that his job was selling stuff. And he would be very good at pointing out to them, this would cost more money if we did this, but this is why it would be better. And not better artistically necessarily, but it would sell better if you did this as well. So I think because it was always rooted in that this is going to sell more, they listen. But I don't remember any fiery anything fiery around him, really. And the department was quite fiery at that time. Yeah. We had sort of Al Tilby and all that kind of stuff going on. There was a lot of fiery stuff around.
Yeah, his temperament, certainly when I was there, it was...
very mild man.
Yeah.
Did you work with him? Did he?
No, we presented a few scripts to him on Alliance and Leicester we worked on. I remember presenting him some scripts. One of them he kept laughing at and throwing his head back. And then he got to the end and went, "Yeah, it's far too derivative." After laughing his head off all the way through.
Was that the Fry and Laurie ones or was that?
No, it was after that. Mm. One of them he really liked was about someone who, because people say he held on to his money or whatever the term is for that. And ironically, the one he really liked, the one that we'd done was about, I think it was when 24-hour banking was coming in, someone who kept phoning up to check their balance all through the night or something. I've got a vague memory. But no, he was sort of kept himself to himself, really. I think everybody obviously wanted to engage with him more, show him work and get stuff out of him, but he sort of did his own thing most of the time. He was almost like attached to the department rather than in the department when I was there. I remember he did come in once. He used to come in with, he was always really nice if we won awards. He'd come in and he came in with a campaign he'd done of posters for Marmite, which I've got all the scribbles. And I think it was just at the time when Richard and Andy were doing Love It, I Hate It, and he'd done a campaign, which was unusual because he didn't used to do anything like that. He didn't do print, but he brought it in. It didn't. I don't know why it didn't go forward or whatever. But no. So I think we said when we were going there, it would be good to understand TV more from John Webster, and they sort of laughed as if he doesn't really do that. He's like, he does his own thing, and occasionally he sort of works for someone. It was interesting going through the names of who he'd had as partners. Collis, Patrick Collister, Frank Budgin. There's like a few people who, Nick Gill occasionally, that he sort of seemed to use in the nicest way. But I don't know, he was probably his own best partner, wasn't he? So all his best stuff was done
on his own. I mean, he was very good with words, and he was very good on the art direction side as well. But I think he did like kind of feeding off other people. And, well, you'll be aware there's a lot of kind of feeling that he rather kind of appropriated other people's ideas quite a lot, and some debate over whether how much that was deliberate or how much was just misremembering, or how much actually it was the kind of magic on the end that he added that really lifted it to greatness anyway. But yeah, I think people kind of, especially around the Martians and the origins of that.
I mean, I think it's funny because I've been trying to get together all these things. The credits change a lot from one award system to the next. I don't know why or what's happening, but on this thing, it's just John. On this thing, it's John and someone else. The same ad, you know, and it's changing all the time. So it's tricky to keep track of them. And I don't know what that is. And I don't know whether that's where that thing comes from. Obviously, there are a few people that we know that feel robbed on certain things. Dave Trott's his biggest champion for saying if he's got his name on anything, it wouldn't be... No one would know about it if he wasn't involved.
Yeah.
You know, he would have sprinkled his magic on it.
It's hard to argue, isn't it? I mean, even if you think of Martians, I mean, I've been involved with two or three ads with Martians in which have been terrible because they're quite hard to kind of depict in engaging ways, aren't they? And there's nothing inherently appealing about a Martian, actually far from it, really. But and I think it was him who drew them with, you know, those little beady eyes and those kind of... That mouth,
it's like two saucepans or something.
Yeah, it's like a really... massive, and those little pincers. I mean, there's just immediately... very endearing, aren't they? And they needn't have been. They could have been quite kind of...
Well, again, all these things in retrospect look easy. But at the time, so what is that, 72? You'd have Star Trek, and Martians were much more sophisticated and techno-looking. They weren't two saucepans and some eyes stuck on.
No, and that was part of the appeal, wasn't it? And then I hadn't actually realised, but do you remember when you used to listen to Ed Stewart's Junior Choice?
Yep.
There was that Laughing Policeman song. That was really big at the time. And that apparently, you know, how he's always kind of... That's where the laughing idea came from. And then the Daleks, obviously, you get the managers. And then space travel was really big at that time as well. So all these little things come together.
But that's the sort of weird... skill to put all that together, you know, because once you get used to it, you know, before I started going through all his stuff again, I thought, well, it's a bit like, you know, reviewing the Beatles. You're sort of so familiar with it all that it's almost not worth looking at again. But actually going through it again, you notice lots of stuff. And if you unfamiliarise yourself with it, that's such a weird way to cast a Martian, or that's such an odd thing to make a straw the star of the thing. You've got Muhammad Ali and the little straw comes in. And I don't know what that is. I suppose that's instinct, isn't it? That's just skill.
Yeah, and we've talked about those random things, haven't we? Like why did the Hofmeister have that kind of pork pie hat?
Yeah.
A lot of them have just got, Yeah. Well, funny enough, Tom Cutler. His clothes were too small, weren't they? He was and he's bursting out.
His trousers were too small.
Yes.
His walk. Tom Carty said that he used to work at Dorland's and he used to meet his mate there, who was a postman, who walked like that. He said, I guarantee he stole that from his mate, who always used to meet me in the there. We would know Webster's there. He said, I never used to talk to him because he was just at Dorland's. He said, I guarantee it's my mate, whatever his name was.
Yeah.
I don't know whether it was.
It probably was.
He's seen all the stuff somewhere and used it. And that sort of slightly cocky walk.
He did always say that, and he said, John Gielgud said this, that when he was acting, that if he got the walk right, he always got the character. And apparently that was one of the kind of unlocks with George the Bear, who started off as the Hofmeister Bear started, as a posh bear. I don't know if you, the original idea was beer with pedigree, because the Hofmeister client wanted it to
be sophisticated.
He had a kind of candelabra and a kind of grand piano, and he had his DJ on and all that sort of stuff. And that came back from researchers like, that's just completely irrelevant to beer drinkers. You know, they want someone who's more kind of, they can identify with more. And then the inspiration apparently was the Fonz, and a bit of Alexei Sayle with the pork pie hat. But he said once he got the kind of Fonz swagger, then the whole character came from that. And that feels right. I actually heard an actor the other day saying that when he was in sort of costume, the shoes were the most important part, because if he got the shoes right,
that would affect the way
it affected everything about. So yeah, maybe it's the same sort of.
He doesn't talk much, does he? The bear.
He goes, "Hey."
That's that the extent of his dialogue. But so obviously he's straight from the can. And he's got his backstory, which I know because it's in the ads from the Bavarian woods.
Yes, yeah.
I'm trying to think of him describing
his grandfather, wasn't it, on the can?
Is that what it was? But I've not really considered, now that you've said that all of these characters had a big backstory. Yeah, the backstory is all in that.
Yeah.
And
often with a vulnerability as well. I mean, you know, the famous story about Arkwright when it was originally researched, he was a kind of loner. And again, obsessed with beer, but nobody wanted to identify with a kind of sad loner. But then he was given his battle axe wife, Tonto, the dog, his mates, the Three Ferrets pub, you know, the kind of the world. And then suddenly it takes off. But I think that's what helped him, because he was brilliant at campaigns, obviously, as well, wasn't he? Which, you know, again, you don't really get so much of now. They kind of run out of steam. But he could just write to these characters because you knew who they were. And
I think he'd seen that Gordon Rawlings, I think his name is. I think he'd seen him in a cult ad from, press ad from 6-7 years before.
Oh, because I read something that maybe it was him talking. He said he was really surprised they ended up casting him, because they originally imagined a much younger drinker, which of course you would imagine clients thinking, if you want to bring young men into Yorkshire, you need someone who looks young. And then Gordon Rawlings came in right at the end, and they just knew that was him.
At the time. That is,
he was an alcoholic as well, I think, which didn't help. I think he died of alcohol, which is not great.
But you're right, it is an unusual, in retrospect, it's totally Yorkshire, but it is unusual to cast such an old person for, presumably they're aiming at a much younger market.
He did cast quite a lot of old people, though, didn't he? I think he was good at old people generally. Well, there was that famous meat and livestock ad where he had the old couple, and then there was that Miller Lite one where the old granny was over. Over his shot on Sony, obviously the Trinitron bit.
And that
was because I think that was. He never put. Well, we were talking earlier about when he did it, it often went quite wrong, but he didn't put kind of. It wasn't like holding mirrors up to the target audience ever, was it? It was always more kind of exaggerated versions of
I think that was probably the same for men eaters. As well, wasn't it, or not? I'm just trying to think whether the men would be as the equivalent of a battle axe or dolly bird would be the two 70s words. But
the Hofmeister drinkers, there were always sort of three mates, weren't there, with the bear. Yeah. They were more kind of target audience, I guess. But I mean, usually he kind of sidestepped all that by having a character, which is like
gets around it.
Yeah.
Or Miller Lite, I suppose there was, he was like a young skinhead. He's quite an interesting character. Different.
Yeah. But we get so hung up, don't we, with kind of representation nowadays. Yeah. And you think you can just sidestep all that if you put a kind of furry animal or something in it, and then it just talks to everybody and it doesn't matter.
It says, didn't think he or his ads were important. That's true. So he had humility and understood that people didn't care about ads, brands.
Yeah, I do. I think that goes back a bit to what we were saying about dried potato products and things. Like, if you've got inherently uninteresting things with not a lot to say about them, and you've got to work pretty hard to make them interesting and entertaining to people. And so, and I think, by implication, he realised people didn't particularly care about brands, and they didn't have massive places in people's lives. So you borrow from the things they do like celebrities or music or characters or catchphrases. It was all about embellishing them with and
borrowed, wasn't it?
Borrowed interest, really.
Lots of famous people in them.
Yes,
like Humphreys. It's full of
them.
Interesting. Spike Milligan, who I think used to live near him in where did he live? High Barnet. I think he was a neighbour. Was in a couple of them. Muhammad Ali, amazingly.
Yeah, or even Henry McGee,
who people would still recognise.
It was just very entertaining
Benny Hill
stuff, wasn't it? And there's a kind of humility about that, I think, that which, again, I don't think a lot of the time we have nowadays, and all that purpose ridiculousness was all about trying to force our kind of views of what people should think and about things on when
the assumption
they
is
don't
people
care.
Are interested.
They really don't give a shit. And that I think if you've got dried potatoes, that kind of forces you to acknowledge that. But I think he kind of knew that anyway. I don't think that needed pointing out to him. But the planning, that all that sitting with real people for hours on and every beat, you kind of, that gave you that kind of grounding as well. And I think when you lose that, you do kind of disappear off into purpose world and think brands are important.
So
and they
when
can
did that
change
start
the
going?
World.
I'd never really considered the research element as much of going into their homes, seeing people on a regular basis, getting that sort of feedback. Was that sort of, I suppose, as digital became more and more prevalent, that started to diminish? There's other ways of, cheaper ways, really, getting a bit of information.
Well, we used to have it as a mantra that, and it really was one, that every ad we made, we would research without exception. Well, not always press ads, but always TV. But then, as you know, we did that merger with Davis and Pierce and then another one with DDB. And then it all started to break down a bit, really. So clients came in who hadn't seen
that.
And so that kind of started to do. And then I think clients got research departments and kind of insight managers, and they then started to want and protect a power base. So they would then, have research agencies that they wanted to use. And I guess it's a trust thing, isn't it? You just, from the outside, it does feel like we're marking our own homework and you're going to let stuff through that isn't work, right. So, and once that then starts to unravel, then, just a combination of things, I think. And then if planners aren't doing so many groups, then you're not so good at it because you don't do it so often. Yeah. And then it just doesn't really happen at all now, apart from pitches, so.
And online, it's hard to get that feel for it.
Oh, God, yeah.
That you used to have.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I always thought, actually, the biggest benefit was actually getting out of London into real people's houses, as much as anything that actually happened in the groups. And also, just as I said, talking about the stuff that wasn't the ads, but all the other stuff around it, that was really... And then bringing that back, all those hours worth of kind of chatting and... Every day, then you can draw on that in your day-to-day life.
But I'm sure you can just think, they're not going to like this. Just going into their home, you must get a sense of where they're at and think, this is not their world or this is not their thing. You can just feel those clashes, can't you?
And because you, we'd always put more than one route. I think we were talking about that earlier. So it let you play a little bit, really. Now it feels it's all so regimented. You've got the discussion guide, and you know, often if you just say, "Well, can't we just, we're doing the research anyway? Why don't we just put it in?" And then the research say, "Oh, we haven't got time for that," or "Yes, you have."
Do you think that happens less then? Because obviously that then changes it from, there is the risk if you're a creative, it feels like you're being judged, and the judgment is you got it wrong, rather than if you think, what can we learn by trying this, by trying that? It's you're using it as a tool rather than you can feel like it's judging you.
Yeah, I mean, I think, would it go, well, you would know, but you know what it feels like to put your work into work that other researchers are research. I mean, you don't know who's doing it even, do you? It just sort of disappears and then you get presented. It must be horrendous.
It's like when they vote for a new pope, you just think, oh, the answer's this.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't often get any sense of why. And it's quite often being researched by someone who doesn't really understand advertising. And what they usually just sort of report back on what people think. But I think what we were good at was trying to sort of always move it on. We'd never come back with just a report. It was, you'd always be taught, like, come back with some views of this isn't working so well, but what if we did this, or they do like these other ads, could we learn anything from that? Or, you know, that was always the frustration when you sat and debriefed from other researchers, that you just got up, so what are we meant to do about it? You're just telling us what.
So it's a bit more like improvisational comedy where you're taught to say yes and rather than no and close it down.
Yeah, absolutely.
We could take that and do X.
And you could sort of go off piste because you haven't got an approved discussion guide. You could suddenly think, oh my God, I wonder what they think about this ad. Have we shown them that? And you could do it. And then and you could do that after, if you've got six groups, you could do it after group number two and you've got four groups left to look at it. Whereas again, now it's like it goes off and they go, every group is run the same because that's what they've been briefed to do. And even if you know this isn't working, there's no sense that you can adapt that or learn any more from it.
I think it's weird as well with, like, System One, who obviously that really great, interviewed Orlando, who I really liked, did that really great book Lemon and some other books. But they seem to have views now on the kind of things you should be doing, which seems weird. Rather, they seem to be attached to certain ways of doing advertising rather than getting responses from it, which seems a bit of a clash to me.
Well, they've certainly,
because if everyone's getting the same, use humour more, use this more, use that more, it seems like it's all going to lead you to the same place. You're trying to separate yourself from all those, everyone else, rather than.
Yeah, and I think that certainly feels like it could become an issue. It becomes a bit of a self-fulfilling thing, doesn't it? You look at the ads that do well and you think, oh, we need to do some more of that. But at some stage, as we know, if everyone's
as you just said, John was saying, do the opposite. If everyone's using full colour, because we got now full colour, let's go black and white, because we're trying to stand out from all of those.
I think, to be fair to System One, that they are kind of actively talking about the ads that do work differently. Yeah. Like our pot noodle one, you'll know the slurp one that we've just done. It doesn't work through sort of happiness and that kind of, you know, fluffy pet type sort of stuff. But still work very well on their spike ratings, as they call it, even though it's caused quite a lot of kind of revulsion in people watching it. So I think there is a growing sense that there's a whole palette of emotions that we should draw on and not just default to the kind of
happiness. Obviously for a while
thing.
It was the sort of John Lewis-y thing took off as the predominant.
Yeah.
I don't know what you'd call that emotion. What would you call that? It was sort of, it
makes you cry. it was like you buy kind of a.
Yeah. Can't think of how you sum it up, but there was a certain sort of emotion that everybody tried to get into, tried to make you feel more deeply and emotionally about things. But I remember the emotion, that was the first place I went to where they used to talk about emotion in the 90s, saying emotion is the most powerful tool. It's such a weird thing to say at the time.
In the 90s, BNP.
Yeah.
Did they?
Because nobody really used to do emotion before that. It was like Yellow Pages, there's the odd bit, but it was considered a slightly schmaltzy American thing. And it was talked about a lot there. and it sort of struck me as being unusual at the time.
In which, in relation to which ads would it be? I'm trying to think.
Just
what
generally,
we were doing
as a there was. I just remember hearing things that I hadn't heard before, which is like emotion is the most powerful tool, and things like that. That at the time there weren't lots of emotional ads. There was lots of funny ads and sensationalist ads, and also sort of emotional was
it's
like.
Got to flip the completely opposite now,
yeah,
isn't
and then
it?
So now it's
and now
like
it's
so much
now
more
the
of a
pendulum's
thing.
Coming.
I don't know what,
back the other way again.
I suppose at the time there would have been things like John's meat and livestock, which were emotional,
yes.
Probably around that time.
Yeah,
but there weren't lots. I don't think.
And they were still done with a bit of humour,
they
weren't
were,
they?
Yeah,
I mean,
they
even
were fun
there was
to
that
watch,
bit at the end where the woman went up, the old lady went upstairs and kind of winked at her husband. There was always a little bit of I'm not really taking this too seriously.
Yeah.
Didn't really do kind of.
But they made you feel slightly emotional, didn't they?
Yes. Oh yeah, yeah. Very kind of very warm. And the thing that I was looking back at, you know, that one that he that Coty Le Mans, and that was the only thing that won a Grand Prix at Cannes, I think, for him. Is that right? I mean, that feels like a weird ad for him to do. And for why did that win such a big award, do you think?
I think because it was in another language. Because it was just, I think it's brilliant. It's really, really nicely shot. I think it's Hugh Hudson.
Yeah.
And because it's a slightly different structure where, I mean, again, it's really well branded. It's the fragrance is a French name, and Le Mans, is it?
Yeah.
And obviously all the dialogue is in French with subtitles, and it's sort of an unusual structure, particularly at the time, and it looks great. It's a funny little story. Yeah, it's a peculiar story, isn't it? The young guy goes over to the woman just as her husband comes along, and then he goes back to his boring friend sort of thing. But, I think it's Hugh Hudson. It does look great,
right?
And I think it's just unusual seeing... dialogue, although ironically Cannes is French, but I think that was in that early 80s period where
he
was trying some slightly
bit off the rails
peculiar
a bit.
Stuff, although that obviously did well.
Because Hugh Hudson did Goethe as well, didn't he? So,
Which look amazing still.
Yes. Yeah. Do you know the story behind that? You got the lighting guy who did Brief Encounter to do that. You got him out of retirement.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
No.
Apparently, Hugh Hudson said to John, if you want something that looks like it was lit as though it was, you know, whenever it was meant to be, that you need someone who was actually around at that time.
Oh, wow.
And so they got him out of retirement to.
I wonder what he did, because they do look like perfect recreations of 30s or 40s.
Done in one take as well.
Oh,
like a sort of one camera action, all
move it around,
kind of, yeah, like a, yeah.
But yeah, they still look to me. They still look brilliant, Goethe. I found a couple of new ones I'd never seen. One called Tokyo, shot by Hugh Hudson, that they obviously didn't enter for awards. But,
no, okay, I don't know that one.
There's quite a few of them.
I looked at the Texas Tom ads. I'd forgotten about that. I worked on those.
Did you?
Yes. Another classic John coming in. We couldn't get anything to work on that, and then it was one of those like bringing John to try and rescue it. And
as a pitch, presumably.
No, I think we'd won it then, and it was I don't know what we'd won it with, but no, it wasn't a pitch, yeah, because it was definitely a client. And I remember researching them, and that was music was something we were going to talk about, wasn't it?
He uses it in an unusual
right
way
at the beginning, rather than. Because
put it in
quite often,
end.
I'm sure you come across scripts which say at the top something like music suitably epic or something like that. I mean, he would never do that. It would always start with the specific.
So would he often have just song in the beginning?
Always.
Always.
I don't remember ever him thinking, I wonder what music we'll put with that. So when he presented to clients, he'd always bring his cassette recorder in, and he got piles of cassettes in his...
Yeah.
Because Dave Trott always said you got sent samples, is that right, from people? And he said that they always used to chuck
music
theirs in the bin,
and,
but he would always listen to his. But that was,
really?
You know, he always said he kept a notepad in his car because he listened to Terry Wogan and write down songs. And the Texas song was something that Terry Wogan used to...
Was it? That came from Wogan?
It was a country and western song called The Devil Inside, which was all about... I mean, again, going back to rather sexist, as this guy used to go around and kind of cheer up bored housewives who were sort of fed up at home.
Is that what that's about?
That's what it's about. And so, he took he took that song and wrote it, because Texas were at the time were trying to get away from being about just men sort of hammers and screws and things like that, and they'd got kitchen sets and things like that, so it was about appealing more to women than John wrote this, started with that song, and it was about a woman who was fed up with her husband, and he got, I mean, it's terrible, he said, got her a new kitchen from Texas Tom Tissue. We've got papers and paints that coordinators, all that, right? But yeah, and they're so easy to research, because we would take it out, you'd play the cassette with the music, and then we'd just kind of flip over the visuals, and the music kind of carries the ad anyway.
Did, obviously did well in research.
Yes, people loved it, yeah.
So that might be the one. I remember Tony Davidson telling me the story of them being stuck. I think it was on a pitch, but it would fit the Texas Tom thing. And they were nowhere like a day before. And John was asked, you know, we've only got a day. And Tony and Kim just had a day. So Tony and Kim stayed virtually all night trying to do it. John went home at six. And then in the morning, Tony and Kim obviously absolutely wrecked. Had some scrawls of bits and pieces. And then John came in all perky and said, and they said, oh, what have you got? He said, it's funny, when I was driving home, I heard this thing on the radio. And I thought, that's good. And then when I was watching TV later in the evening, thingy was on. And I thought, maybe if we use it. So it's just ironic that they'd been there sweating, and actually his use of going home and having a normal night, he'd taken something from the radio and something he'd seen on TV that night.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was Texas Tom or what it was, but it just makes you feel like an idiot if you'd been sat there banging your head against the table all night.
But also they would, they're kind of evidence of popularity, the fact they're being played on the radio anyway and on TV. Yeah. You're putting together things that are already popular, aren't
random
you?
Random theories,
So would you not work like that? Would you not put things together in that way? Was that very unusual?
Well, the way there's not many people who, I mean, even when you're talking through Hofmeister, it's like a jazz level thing to say, let's have Alexi Sal's hat, Fonzie's walk. I can't remember the other things that went. He's got like a silk Radio 2 DJ's jacket, hasn't he?
Yes, he has, yeah. Like a blues on sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then his trousers are too short. Who was the walk? Potentially that the postman.
Fonz, all that
Prince
postman.
Of Wales, whoever it is.
But oh, and then that percussive sort of blast on the end, which was quite Lauren Hardy-esque.
Where does that come from?
I don't know, but that was quite swaggery, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That kind of.
To put together those random things is, I don't really know. I can't really think of anyone else.
And the brutal simplicity of a bear as well. Because the one thing the client said apparently when they briefed us on Hofmeister, we don't want a bear because we've had that before. And that's obviously the only thing they did have. But
So to sort of, you know, courage, I think Dave Trott went to the pub and heard Chaz and Dave. And then somehow they've, you can imagine how that works. And you go, well, let's set it back then. But to mesh all these things together, as he did often. I can't think who else. There must be other people who do that kind of thing, but I don't think there's lots.
Mm.
I don't know who they are. You know, most people, you know, write clear, funny scripts sometimes, or this script, but it's just this weaving of, I suppose it's weaving of cultural bits and pieces and the music. Like Texas Tom. And then you've got that sort of, it's almost like a Laurel and Hardy. He's like an awkward little kid thing at the end, isn't he? And which obviously makes it nice. It stops it. It's all serious. And then there's this sort of... Yeah, he's like a kid at a wedding or something. It just sort of...
Makes it kind of lovable. If that was a cool-looking, good-looking bloke, it wouldn't work at all, would it? Then?
Or the same with the Smash Martians. You know, you've got the Dalek, which is quite sophisticated and serious. You've got the laughing policeman.
Yeah.
You've got the sort of these things that look like they're made out of tin pans, pots and pans or something.
Yeah. And wasn't it based on that Bob Newhart sketch about tobacco as well? explaining to the Elizabethan about
you do what with it?
So yeah, you put it in your mouth and you set fire to it.
Yeah.
So that.
Yeah. So that's what I mean. That
there's a lot of crunching, isn't it?
I'm trying to think who else it would bring up, if anyone. To weave together those things.
Yeah, it is like a kind of tapestry of sort of...
It's like plate spinning, all those things. It looks obvious in retrospect. But
so is that because he just remembered more or actively collected more or was just... I mean, he was old, wasn't he? In these heyday years, he was in his 50s then. Mm. So I suppose you've had 30-odd years of collecting all this stuff as well.
Well, I'm trying to think. When he's doing, let's say, Hofmeister... Mm. That's 85. How old is he in 85? Do you know?
He was, well, I joined the year after Points of View, and I think he was 55 when he did that, which was...
It's about the same time.
Yeah. Bit before, so in his 50s anyway. Yeah. Maybe when you haven't got anything to prove and you're not kind of young and thrusting, and I don't know, maybe you're more open to that sort of
I did wonder how his situation there is, whether that was... because obviously he was never going to be fired. He was never trying to impress anyone in case he was fired, which is useful. Because I was thinking about the research and the planning and, you know, the description of some people say creativity is just play. So to be in that mind state, you have to be relaxed, you know, whereas a lot of people at the moment think they might get fired.
Yeah, I think that's
soon.
Very
so it's hard to be really playful and... try stuff out when you think they could be trying to get rid of people at the end of the month. And obviously he's in a situation where he's sort of out on his own.
Yeah.
Not going to be fired and just playing, really.
Relieved of managerial duties. Yeah. Never wanted to run a
Didn't really do the creative director. No. It dipped in and out now and again as creative director, but didn't
want to do it. It was always allowed the sort of freedom to, play and sort of dip in and out. And weirdly, it was very interesting when... I mean, I only really knew him latterly, so he would be brought in at the last minute when no one else could do it. And he didn't like that sort of pressure. I remember him always saying, is anyone else on this?
And
we'd always say yes, even if they weren't, because you could see him relax more if he felt it wasn't all on him. So I guess that all comes back to being in that kind of relaxed, playful mindset.
Yeah.
And getting away at the end of the day as well, as you say, not just sitting up all night.
Not sitting there all night sweating. Well, he probably... all going on in his head,
but I guess he just had a huge kind of mental pantry of stuff, really. It was all this stuff that he's collected and remembered, and
I don't know. I mean, lots of people collect stuff and collect references, but knowing how to use them is obviously the unusual skill, and also putting together things that don't necessarily, you know, if you do a pastiche of a space thing, you can pull in all your space stuff, but thinking, I know he didn't do this, but let's have an Alexei Sell character in this space thing, and let's have just things that are not natural to go there and sort of put them together.
Because I've done that crest, I've forgotten with the crest of bear, there was, is it Thurber, the cartoonist, that based on that, and then there was a film he saw about a teenage girl running off with a kind of cool boyfriend, and then... Then there was obviously the Jack Nicholson scene from Easy Rider. The animator who did
Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, so again, getting really good people to do that. And then the voice, he always sort of loved the voice of the... He got this Canadian guy to do the Cresta Bear voice, and that... Again, he sort of said the voice and the kind of walk. Once you got that, you got the kind of character. So,
but when you're describing that, it sounds like if anybody could have done that, they would have recognised that's it. But I don't know what's leading him to go, yeah, that's it, the walk, the voice. You know, it's like, I don't know, really.
Mm. And it always felt like he could imagine. He always said he hated writing a script because it felt... kind of reductive. He wished he never had to write a script because it was sort of there in his head as a sort of whole thing, and he knew what he wanted it to look like and sound like and feel like. And I think it was maybe it was that like that with all of you, I don't know, but it just felt like it was never like here's the script and here's the voice. It was just a thing that he had in his head and he could see and knew what he wanted it to look like, right down to the kind of last detail, although it evolved over time, as we say. But when he was talking about the Jack D and the penguins, you know, he was talking about how he always envisaged it with Jack's side on and the penguin sort of dancing around in front like that. There's quite a graphic kind of...
Well, there's lots of them, as I say, that are locked off.
Mm.
Tons of these things are literally locked off camera and something happening, from Jack D to through to the National Provincial. Is it National Provincial? Tons of them.
Mm.
That are simple graphic things.
Yeah.
But I was also thinking of the other reference thing, which is mixing Giacometti and Benjamin Britten.
Yes, yeah.
Which looks like they're made for each other. When you watch the thing, you think that's the perfect marriage.
Yes.
But they're not necessarily when you start out.
No, I think he liked crunching things, didn't he? There was that thing about how he completely bowled over by the 2001 Space Odyssey, that docking scene where he had the Blue Danube, and he loved that story he always used to tell about how that was an accident. Yeah, and I think that, and he always used music in that.
Opposites,
which a lot of people don't do they? They do the kind of music that fits rather than clashes. Yeah. So hard to analyse, isn't it?
I don't know how
he pull it off.
Obviously, we talked a little bit about his casting, which was quite diverse, although that wouldn't have been described that way at the time.
Mm.
And I guess, the thing that I suppose the biggest skill is understanding what's going to be, he would call it catchy, we might call it viral now, but because the amount that went viral is, I mean, even the prize guys, which I think is amazing to me, because I can remember watching those at school and everybody liked those. And it's the most sort of seemingly crass idea of the product talking and surfing, and I don't really know why that caught on or why that seemed like it was cool. Something to do with the voiceover. I don't really know.
Yeah.
But it wasn't quite Humphrey's level or Crestabet, but it was a thing. Mm. It was a cool...
Yeah, I remember that when I was at school.
And I don't know, why is that? That's talking yoghurt pots. It couldn't be more naff in a way, could
and
it?
And that schmaltzy kind of...
And I think, it's obviously something to do with the way it's so over the top. Or it's like a slight clash of it being quite a... crass thing, but then this over the top voiceover. I don't even know why it worked.
No, I mean,
don't
some
know
of
why
them
you'd set off on that idea,
no,
thinking
I don't.
That's going to work.
No, I mean, you can see how.
I don't know what it was based on.
It did seem like it wasn't an accident. He did deliberately load stuff in. So, I mean, apparently, when the crest of it, he was doing that kind of timber and the little rinsy call because he knew
he
that people
that would. Be,
yeah,
they'd pick that
would
up.
Pick that up. Because he picked up things as well. He loved accents and sort of funny expressions and things like that. So I think he did load and the walks. And because people did mimic his stuff, didn't they? There's not doesn't happen so much now. You don't maybe with Compare the Market, but you don't get people mimicking ads in the same way.
No, they've fallen down with pecking.
But lots of his did that. So I did think he did deliberately load stuff in. Because there's no other way of things going viral then, was it? It had to be in playgrounds and catchphrases and jingles and slogans and actions and accents and things like that. And we've lost a bit of that. I think we've got lazy just because people can do it with social media. We don't load the stuff in.
It's easier for things to go viral now.
Mm.
But they rarely do they?
Mm.
Certainly TV commercials.
Well, it's all got rather derided, hasn't it? Sort of repetition, slogans, jingles, all that stuff. Yeah. Everyone's rather sniffy about it all, but making things easy to remember is a good thing.
Why is that? Why is that? Because all of these tools, as we started off talking about, aren't the popular tools of today. So rhyming and lines on rhyming, jingles, characters. Characters, you don't see many, do you? I wonder why that is.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what. I mean, they're not fashionable, are they?
That's
they're
what
not
I mean. It
cool.
feels like they're out of fashion rather than.
Yeah.
But obviously they've been proven to, I think Paul Feldwick said that when we did our thing, that they're all the most powerful tools.
They are, and System One have done a lot of research on that. You know, the power of characters, and characters are better sort of distinctive assets than anything else you can use. So, well, the fact that there are less campaigns, I think there's a bit of a pushback against that now as well. But obviously repetition is a big thing, and without that, it's hard to remember things and repeat things and share them. But all these things, I think, are swinging a little bit back into fashion.
You think so?
As is humour.
You think campaigns are likely to come back? Because I remember when digital first started to be a thing, it was like, well, you don't need to do campaigns anymore because you can reach people instantly and reach them again. You don't need to think about, they don't need to remember it, which was the big goal.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. I mean, System One have just recently done a huge bit of work on what they call compound creativity, which is quite a smart way of saying consistency, but
issue.
Sounds a bit more kind of fun than just doing the same things again and again. But yes, it's being, there was a kind of, you probably heard of the sort of wear out was something that but it was never actually proven to be a thing, but just a sort of common sense view that ads wore out, but that's been proven just not to happen at all.
No.
You don't see anything enough times for it to wear out. In fact, they wear in most. As that's been quashed and more research is coming in showing that the ads that are really paying back the most are things like Specsavers and Yorkshire Tea or whatever, you know, we call old-fashioned campaigns, really. So it's not about literally running the same ad again and again, but having something like Marmite Love Hate that you can creatively play
refreshing
with.
Refreshing rather
than... Yes. Yeah, I mean, in the music industry, they call it disguised repetition. So you're kind of doing the same thing, but you're doing it in a slightly different way. That's all... The research is now showing that that does work. So that will... I think we'll be seeing more of it.
It always used to seem like the agencies got bored with it first.
Yeah.
Then it was the client, and last it would be the public, you know, that they wouldn't be bored, they wouldn't, because they weren't interested in the first place, you know, they certainly weren't familiar with it.
But I mean, all his, I mean, the sugar, but the Honey Monster still, I mean, slightly knocked back form, but he's still around, isn't he? And Walker's ran forever.
Yeah.
Walker's System One years. Actually, just as a sort of experiment, did a test on the Smash Martians and I think the Honey Monster ad a couple of years ago. So to people who probably never even seen it before, and it was still it was one of the top scoring star ads. You think, oh God, so how many other ads from the 1970s could you run now and people still... I went to one of Peter Kay's big kind of stadium things at the O2 last year. It's probably not a very cool thing to go to, but anyway, he does popular well. And I don't know, but the first 15 minutes of that set, him and thousands of people singing ad jingles from the 70s.
Oh, really?
I mean, literally word for word, with no auto prompt or whatever. They're just singing A Finger of Fudge and the Pakiest. Okay. You're just going through, how many ads now will people be able to sing in 30 years' time? It's just extraordinary how it works, that kind of memory. But
so do you think that will come in fashion again, if it's out of fashion now?
I think it will, yeah. I mean, I think it is. Certainly, it's a revelation, this idea that there isn't such a thing as wear out, because generations of marketers have just been brought up to buy into that without any evidence. You just kind of think,
how that affects agencies.
Mm. Well,
if you do things that last longer,
it's...
I suppose you're potentially still refreshing.
Yes, but, I think there's some people would say, it's not so interesting for creatives. Well, you tell me. But then I say, look at Marmite. I mean, creatives are still killed to work
on.
And so there's, in a way, it should be really liberating because you shouldn't ever get a bad branding score because it's so, that association is so built.
Idea,
so you've got permission to play around it. And Specsavers do... Yeah. Brilliant stuff,
they do
don't
really
they?
Good,
Rick Astley and sort of their special builds, and so and Yorkshire Tea. And hopefully, it's creatively much more interesting because you've got the kind of basics there, and you can play more with them. So it's got to be good to start with. But
how do we end? How do we wrap up?
Well, I wonder what John would think of if he came back and looked at this. I think he'd like the meerkats. I think that's very him. I think he'd like Specsavers.
I think in looking at all his stuff again, I sort of knew this But I was reminded of it even more. It's just how simple and clear it was. It was almost so. It was almost some of it was almost bizarrely simple. That feels like I don't know why. It was like I was saying, you know, there's one script. It would be a guy reads through his bills and laughs for 60 seconds. And there was quite a lot like that that you think.
Yeah, it was. It was brutally simple.
Minimal.
I did talk to Hugh Hudson when I wrote the book, and he said that was the thing, that he had this childlike simplicity that he could just push away everything that wasn't the core to the idea and just. And I do remember when I talked to John, he'd just say, "But what is the idea? You know, what is it really about?" And he was just
the
so.
Thing people are going to take out.
Yeah, take out all that. I mean, I don't imagine you'd ever get. I mean, not that his ads were ever quantitatively pre-tested, but so many ads now you test and the comprehension scores are just like, I mean, you just got to watch telly at night.
Yeah.
What was all that about? But I don't think you'd ever look at one of his ads and what was all that about? It was just super clear, wasn't
it? Even if you didn't like it, you would absolutely get it as clear as
saying. So if you always got brilliant branding and it's super clear on the comprehension, then you're off to a pretty flying start, really, to kind of play within it. So, yeah, you just got those basics really, really right, I think.
Do you think it's difficult looking back on these things? Because a lot of the ads we've been talking about, let's say from the 80s, we're not judging it and what's around it. You sometimes judge it against what's happening now.
Mm.
And perhaps the competition was really complicated then, I don't know. But certainly now, as lots of ads come up and... If you paid me, I couldn't explain why they exist or what they're about or what they're saying. They just seem like random, cool stuff. But I don't know whether that would have been the case then. It doesn't seem like it, but maybe it was. I don't know.
I do think there's more focus on a sort of idea across a kind of this way down idea now, a kind of that works across different platforms rather than ideas that work as campaigns over time. And so it feels much more, it has to work in, you know, so many different surfaces and across all the media or whatever. And then that all just gets very complicated, doesn't it? But I think that is a change. I mean, it was basically TV, wasn't it, really, when he didn't actually, as you said, I don't remember doing anything even across a poster and a TV ad.
I think posters he called Below the Line, I think.
Yes.
Or something like that.
But I guess, there was a Channel 4 survey at the end turn of the millennium that was like Britain's favourite ads. It was Britain's 100 favourite ads, and they did it in the year 2000, and 10 of them were John's. So you think to have 10% of the British public's favourite ever ads. So it was good even for his time, I suppose, is what I'm saying. It wasn't just that... which is
it's always a danger that you think, well, this is how it was then. They're all as good as John's ads from then. And it wasn't at all.
No.
Stood out at the time.
And I got a lovely original thing in the book where John's put a tick against all his 10 ads in the 100. I think that's... And you must feel so chuffed, mustn't you? That, you know, that Rembrandt quote, like, you know, millions of people see it, better make it good. I guess he must have felt then that he'd actually made it pretty good, really. Then.
I wonder whether he was... Because you didn't get a sense of being cocky or being... Mm. Arrogant or any of that, I don't know. But underneath, I wonder whether he must have been pretty.
Must have been pretty chuffed by it.
Chuffed, whatever the words.
Mm. But yeah, he was always. Yeah, I don't ever feel like he was resting on his laurels. He was always.
Yeah.
I suppose that's the thing about advertising, isn't it? You just never feel that's it. I've done it. I'm good at it. I know all there is to know because just every problem is different and. Well, that's the kind of lovely and super frustrating thing about it as well, but I think he probably felt that too.
Do you know what the last ad he did was? I don't know.
That's a very good question. I mean, I don't think it would have been
Tropicana.
Yes, it wouldn't have been one of his sort of belters, I don't think.
No.
It went all a bit not great at the end. There were the PG Birds, do you remember that?
Yep.
Which never really It was a kind of chimp replacement, and it was Aardman, but it never really did.
It was a sort of colourful Marmite campaign. I think he did when I was there.
Yeah, you're right. There was the Tropicana parrots, which I quite like. And then he did do a Hovis ad, a sort of South Park
Hovis, that's
animated
what I'm
thinking.
One. I say Marmite.
I think that,
the very brightly coloured kids.
Yeah, I think that might be the last one.
But still trying and playing in different areas and trying to find different looks.
Yeah. And there was a very definite sort of brief that you would give John in those days, and Hovis would be a classic, weren't they?
Yeah.
You know, sort of Heartland, Britain kind of stuff. But
let's. I'm going to wait for the revolution that's about to happen that you've said. You promised me is going to.
You heard it here first.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great to chat.
Thank you.
Thanks for that, Sarah.
Great.